श्रीमद् भागवतम की प्रभुपाद की। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयं मुदीरयेत् नष्टप्रायेषु अपत्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भगवती उत्तम श्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। टुडे वी आर स्टार्टिंग अ न्यू चैप्टर कैंटो नाइन चैप्टर 15 टेक्स्ट 1 परशुराम द लॉर्ड्स वॉरियर इनकार्नेशन। And we are going to do from text 1 till 9 or 10. Till 10 is okay or till 9? Okay. This chapter describes the history of Gadi in the dynasty of Aila. From the womb of Urvashi came six sons named Ayu, Shrutayu, Satyayu, Raya, Jaya and Vijaya. The son of Shrutayu was Vasuman. The son of Satyayu was Shrutanjaya. The son of Raya and Eka. The son of Jaya was Amita. And the son of Vijaya was Bhima. Bhima's son was named Kanchana. The son of Kanchana was Hotraka. And the son of Hotraka was Janu, who was celebrated for having drunk all the water of the Ganges in one sip. The descendants of Janu, one after another, were Puru, Balaka, Ajaka, and Kusha. The sons of Kusha were Kusambu, Tanaya, Vasu, Kusanabha. From Kusambu came Gadi, who had a daughter named Satyavati. Satyavati married Richaka Muni after the Muni contributed a substantial dowry. And from the womb of Satyavati by Richaka Muni, Jamadagni was born. The son of Jamadagni was Rama or Parshurama. When a king named Kartavirya Arjuna stole Jamadagni's desire cow, Parshurama, who is ascertained by learned experts to be a Shakti Avesha incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, killed Kartavirya Arjuna. Later, he annihilated the Kshatriya dynasty 21 times. After Parashurama killed Kartavirya Arjuna, Jamadagni told him that killing a king is sinful and that as a Brahmana, he should have tolerated the offense. Therefore, Jamadagni advised Parashuram to atone for his sin by traveling to various holy places. I'll just read translations of all the verses. Text 1. Sukadev Goswami continued, O King Parikshit, from the womb of Urvashi, six sons were generated by Pururava. These names were Ayu, Shrutayu, Satyayu, Raya, Vijaya and Jaya. Text 2. Then son of Shrutayu was Vasuman. The son of Satyayu, Shrutanjaya. The son of Raya, Eka, the son of Jaya, Amita, and the son of Vijaya, Bhima. The son of Bhima was Kanchana. The son of Kanchana was Hutraka, and the son of Hutraka was Janu, who drank all the water of the Ganges in one sip. King Gadi had a daughter named Satyavati, whom a Brahmana named Richaka requested from the king to be his wife. King Gadi, however, regarded Richaka as an unfit husband for his daughter, and therefore he told the Brahmana, My dear sir, I belong to the dynasty of Kusha. Because we are aristocratic Kshatriyas, you have to give some dowry for my daughter. Therefore, bring at least 1,000 horses, each as brilliant as moonshine, and each having one black ear, whether right or left. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. The son of King Gadi was Vishwamitra, who was said to be a Brahmana and Kshatriya combined. Vishwamitra attained the status of a Brahmarishi, as explained later. From the marriage of Satyavati with Richika Muni would come a son with the spirit of a Kshatriya. King Gadi demanded that an uncommon request be fulfilled before the Brahmana Richika could marry his daughter. When King Gadi made this demand, the great sage Richika could understand the king's mind. Therefore, he went to the demigod Varuna and brought from him the 1,000 horses that Gadi had demanded. After delivering these horses, the sage married the king's beautiful daughter. Thereafter, Richika Muni's wife and mother-in-law, each desiring a son, requested the Muni to prepare an oblation. Thus, Richika Muni prepared one oblation for his wife with a Brahmana mantra and another for his mother-in-law with the Kshatriya mantra. Then he went out to bathe. Meanwhile, because Satyavati's mother thought that the oblation prepared for her daughter, Richika's wife, must be better, she asked her daughter for that oblation. Satyavati therefore gave her own oblation to her mother and ate her mother's oblation herself. A husband naturally has some affection for his wife. Therefore, Satyavati's mother thought that the oblation prepared for Satyavati by the sage Richika must have been better than her own oblation. In Richika's absence, the mother took the better oblation from Satyavati and ate it. I think I won't do text 10. That's pretty. I'll do till text 9. Is that okay? Is that okay? Or you want me to do text 10 also? Okay. When the great sage Richika returned home after bathing and understood what had happened in his absence, he said to his wife, Satyavati, "You have done a great wrong. Your son will be fierce Kshatriya, able to punish everyone, and your brother will be a learned scholar in spiritual science. A Brahmana is highly qualified when he can control his senses and mind, when he is learned scholar in spiritual science, and when he is tolerant and forgiving. A Kshatriya, however, is highly qualified when he is fierce in giving punishment to wrongdoers. These qualities are stated in Bhagavad Gita 18.42 and 43. Because Satyavati, instead of eating her own oblation, had eaten that which was meant for her mother, she would give birth to a son imbued with the Kshatriya spirit. This was undesirable. The son of a Brahmana is generally expected to become a Brahmana. But if such a son becomes fierce like a Kshatriya, he is designated according to the description of the four Varnas in Bhagavad Gita. Chatur Varnyam Maya Shrishtam Gunash Karma Vibhashkashaha. If the son of a Brahmana does not become like a Brahmana, he may be called a Kshatriya, Vaishya or Shudra, according to his qualifications. The basic principle for dividing society is not a person's birth, but his qualities and actions. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyana Jana Shalakya Chakshurun Milita Mena Tasme Shri Guruve Namaha Namam Vishnupadaya Namam Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutli Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamin Itinamine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pashyate Desha Tharine. Thank you all for joining for today's Bhagavatam class, and giving me an opportunity to speak. Many of these first few verses don't, from 1 till 4, we don't have any purport. And in text 6, So basically, Richika Muni expresses to Gadi that he would like to marry his daughter. And Richika is a Muni, and his Gadi's daughter, Satyavati, who is a very highly qualified lady, she's Kshatriya. So generally, in a Kshatriya community, the princess is, like, there is a Swayamvar, and she gets to choose a husband of her choice according to, and the father actually has a particular, you know, task or something that the prospective husbands have to do to prove that they are qualified to be husband to his daughter. So, but here Richika, he's a Muni, so Satyavati didn't have an opportunity to go through this whole process of Swayamvar. And Gadi was actually making a material calculation. He was not very sure if Richika Muni is qualified to be his daughter's husband. So he puts a condition that he needs to go and find 1,000 horses, and they're not like ordinary regular horses. He was very specific. It has to have 1 year black. Well, he gave some concession. He said it can be a black, a right or left ear. Like, he didn't say it has to be only left ear. So he was a little merciful on Richika Muni. So he said, okay, one of the ears need to be black. And one may wonder, like, somebody, like, especially if you think that any personality who is mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, they're actually glorifiable. That's the reason the names are being mentioned in Bhagavatam. And there's a purpose why they're in being mentioned in Bhagavatam. So Richika Muni, even though he's not one of those Munis that we hear about on a regular basis, but since he's a Brahmana in those days, they're highly qualified. They're powerful and they're highly qualified. So one may wonder, if somebody who is highly qualified, how come this desire to marry and then make the efforts to go and find these 1,000 horses, which he eventually goes to Varuna, you know, I don't know how Varuna has those horses he created or he just had it, and Bhagavatam doesn't mention, but he makes all these efforts to go find these 1,000 horses with one black ear. One may wonder why so much of an effort. And I think the reason being that the king was testing, or in general, it's not that these munis are driven by deep sexual desire and that's prompting them that they look at a beautiful woman and they want to marry. But the point I feel is that to do these tasks, it's not easy. They're not ordinary tasks. It takes a lot of, from the person's side, the effort to go. Sometimes they have to fight, to get something, to win the hand of a princess, of a woman. What it shows is that one needs to be ready. If one is ready to take responsibility of a dependent, no matter how difficult life gets, no matter what the challenge is, the person will, whether he will give up or he will not give up, it's a test to that. So that is the reason why these things are done. It's not that you have to be chivalrous and you have to show how strong you are. Those are the external reasons, but the internal reasons is, are you really capable of protecting and going to any length to take care of your dependents? And that's why these munis, it's not that they have an ego trip that they have to prove a point. The point they're proving is that we are capable of taking care of our dependents. So a king or a father puts these kind of challenges. It's not like, In one sense, Gadi was motivated by the material. He was making a material calculation here. Oh, seems like he's not really well off. No, because you need wealth, because if you want to enter a grihastha ashram, you need to have some money, some wealth, to take care of the needs of the, you know, having a house, to run a household life. So he didn't have wealth, so he had to prove that, you know, I can take care, I'm capable of taking care, and I'm qualified to be a husband. So this is one point through this purport we can take. And then what happens is that both the mother and the daughter, finally, like when he gets the horses, the king agrees, and Satyavati gets married to Richaka Muni. And then what happens is that mother and daughter, Satyavati and her mother, the queen, both desire to have sons. And Richaka, being a Muni, he actually offers oblations in one for a Kshatriya son and one for a Brahmana son. So Satyavati was supposed to honor the oblations that, like, you know, had the mantras for having a Brahmana son, because he was a Muni, and the mother was a queen. She's, you know, father is a Kshatriya, king. So it was supposed to, she was supposed to get a Kshatriya son. And he goes to, he performs the oblation, and then he goes to take a bath. Meanwhile, the mother requests the daughter, can I have what your husband, like the oblation that's for you? And the daughter very dutifully gives it to the mother. Now, this actually addresses a very fundamental human nature, because the mother thought, Richaka, of course, you know, any husband, in the purport Prabhupada mentions that a husband has a natural affection for his wife. So the mother thought, of course, you know, her oblation will be better than mine. So she wanted that, and the daughter dutifully gave it. So this is the human mentality. We always want to compare ourselves with others. You know, something somebody has, and we think, oh, maybe what he or she has is better than what I have. And we have this tendency that, oh, it would be so nice if my situation can be like that, or if I have certain facilities, you know. And as a devotee also, it's not just people out there who have this tendency. It's not just about having iPhones and, you know, Apple computers and a big house. It's not, those are, you know, okay, those are for people, like, you know, out there. But what about us, you know, who are part of this institution, part of this community? We have this tendency. We feel that somebody else's preaching program is better than our preaching program, or somebody has, you know, better kirtan skills than I have, or somebody can give an awesome Bhagavatam class than I do. And we are constantly, each one of us who is here, we're constantly making this comparison. It's hard to say, you have to be really very advanced devotee to believe that you don't have the tendency. Because we had this disease for eternity in the spiritual world also when we were with Krishna. We compared ourselves with Krishna. We felt Krishna is enjoying, he is having fun. How come I'm not the center? So this comparison has been there with us, this tendency, for eternity. And where does this desire, or this, anartha or unwanted feeling come from? It comes from the feeling of not feeling satisfied from within. Not being satisfied in whatever situation, whatever position we are in. We always feel, like one feels like, you know, something else out there is better for me. And, you know, if I can get that, I can get satisfied. If, like, you know, and to be very honest, I have the tendency. You know, what to speak about others, I can speak about myself. I have the tendency. Whenever going gets difficult, I feel, hey, you know, why don't I change my situation, or maybe, you know, if what the other person is doing, if I can be in that situation, I can feel so much more better. But it's like One can never be satisfied as long as we are comparing ourselves with others. And actually in Bhagavad Gita it is said, like, you know, how can one be, like, totally be satisfied? And it says that actually, like, the mind can be, yeah, a satisfied mind is the one, where, a satisfied person is the one who has, like, whose mind is under control. Like, whose mind can be at peace, whose mind is not restless, going from one thought to another thought, or from one object to another object, or from one situation to another situation. So Bhagavad Gita says, you know, for the mind to be calm like that, there are five austerities of the mind. One is satisfaction. Two is simplicity. Three is gravity. Four is sense control. Five is wanting, the desire to want to purify one's existence. So, and our founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada has clearly exhibited all these qualities. If you see that in his whole journey, like, you know, from the day he met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur till the moment he left this planet, he had very ambitious plans. Like, you know, he had this strong determination that I have to fulfill my spiritual master's instruction. I need to start a worldwide movement. Took several years. Didn't lose his heart. Kept his focus even when he was in grihastha life. And eventually when he did come to the Western world, to America, there were obstacles. He would make some plans and obstacles would come. But he didn't give up. He didn't give up. He was... Even though the external circumstances were frustrating, but within his heart he was very satisfied. He was satisfied that, in the sense that in his relationship with his spiritual master, he had this faith that since I have this this instruction, the empowerment is there for me to fulfill that instruction. It's just the time that's keeping us apart. Like, you know, there is this whole pastime where Prabhupada, you know, was envisioning this whole worldwide movement, and he said that what's separating him from that is just time. So he was satisfied. And why was he satisfied? Because he was very simple. He was not looking at other impersonal teachers who were in Manhattan preaching, like Jiddu Krishnamurti and all these people. You know, they were very successful, you know, attracting membership of very rich people in New York, and Prabhupada was in Bowery, and he was very simple, and he said, you know, wherever Krishna puts me, whatever the situation is, I'm going to preach. He didn't get disturbed. And the simplicity of mind, it's very difficult. It's very difficult to keep the mind simple, because at this moment we are constantly bombarded with information, with situation. Life is at a very fast pace, very stressful. And how do you slow down the mind? How do you become simple? One way is to very deeply contemplate what Prabhupada has given us, you know, because everything is in Prabhupada's book. It's true. All the secrets, all the formulas for success is in his Prabhupada's books. And if we can read them and meditate on them and actually have faith that if I apply these principles in my life, you know, eventually I'll reach my spiritual goal. And even if the circumstances are going up, and principles don't change because of circumstances, principles are absolute. Like, they remain valid. They were valid in Satya Yuga and they're valid even today. And they'll be valid as, you know, Kali Yuga progresses. It's not going to change. So, but the circumstance may put doubts in our mind. And we may think that, oh, it doesn't work. Like, for instance, It's a common challenge we have. There is only one Srila Prabhupada, you know, and when Prabhupada was there, his disciples had the confidence that whatever Prabhupada said is absolute. And over the years, in the past 50 years, we have faith in Prabhupada, but we don't put the same kind of faith in the next generation of devotees, because we saw a lot of mistakes being made. And we doubt, you know, how do I know that how I'm being guided by my temple president or by my bhakta leader or my spiritual master or anybody who is your authority in your life? How do, you know, I don't know, you know, they are fallible people. And, you know, I don't think they can guide me, you know. So to the extent my faith allows, I will submit myself. And after that, I'm again on my own. Oh, I'll depend on Prabhupada's books. I depend. No, it doesn't work like that. Prabhupada's books are there, but still you need a teacher. You need a superior to guide you, to guide us and to show us the path. Because before Prabhupada also, we had our acharyas who have commented about, you know, the scriptures and who have given their purports. You know, we have Baladev Vidya Bhushan and we have Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's, you know, purports. But still Prabhupada wrote, because there was a purpose. And Prabhupada said, like, you know, we have Prabhupada's books, but we still need teachers to help us understand how to read these Prabhupada's books. So, yes, some of, you know, a temple president or a bhakta leader or a ashram leader or a college preacher, a father, a mother, may not be transcendental, may not be super advanced, may make mistakes in how they guide you, you know, or what they say. But if your connection with that person is based on the principles that Prabhupada has given in his books, and if the person who is guiding you according to the principles that Prabhupada has given in his books, we are protected. And we'll get the exact medicine that we need for our advancement. Even if external circumstances seems like it's not working in our favor. It doesn't mean that today it's not relevant. Those principles are not relevant. They're very relevant. The extent to which we put faith in the person who is, you know, guiding us or who is helping us, to that extent Krishna empowers that person to guide you. And that's how that's the understanding of what disciplic succession means. If we can't, if our generation cannot put that kind of, you know, faith in the person, you know, in a person who is, you know, the previous generation, then you know what yoga brashta will happen. What is yoga brashta? Then the disciplic succession is like, you know, will not continue. So for the continuity to happen, it is our responsibility to have faith and to act on those principles. And then we will get qualified to pass those principles to the next generation. It is very easy to read Prabhupada's books and get inspiration, and, you know, because Prabhupada's words are so powerful. You know, they're extremely powerful. But when you do it the right way, they are guaranteed to give results. So that's the reason it is very important that, coming back to our point of comparison, each one of us, like, if we have this genuine desire to connect with the disciplic succession, to have this genuine desire to follow these principles, then there is no question of comparison, because each individual soul, you will understand, is being empowered according to their disposition, according to their sincere desire to do what they want to do. So where is this question of being? And that's the simplicity in accepting that this is how Vedic principles work. Because you, if we are comparing ourselves with others and feeling, you know, disturbed and feeling frustrated, and it's we are going nowhere. But if you see that, oh, you know, if this person is doing good, good for them. Like, you know, oh, this person is really internalizing what he's hearing or what she's hearing and reading, and they're applying, and so Krishna is reciprocating. So if I want to please Krishna, so I need to apply myself. So there is then this from the, and naturally we'll feel satisfied. And then there is this question of jealousy, envy doesn't even come. Because you are totally satisfied in your relationship with Krishna and Guru. Where is the question of feeling the struggles we have with, you know, having envy and jealousy in our heart is because we are unable to access all that mercy and all that love that Krishna actually wants to give us. And we don't have confidence in that. So then we think that, oh, somebody else is being empowered more, or somebody else is being loved more, or somebody else is being gifted more. And then we become naturally envious and jealous, and we mess up the whole thing. So we have, as practicing devotees, it's hard, but, and whatever you're hearing today or whatever I'm saying is nothing new, you all have heard it, but we have to keep repeating this to ourselves so that we can keep reminding ourselves, and we keep, like, you know, strengthening our determination. Because that's what it is to be. We have to be very determined in our daily practices, moment to moment. It, like, we have to, like, make that conscious effort and be very present in our relationship with Krishna. Because generally, two things happen. At least I have observed in my own personal life. I can only speak for myself. I don't know how others, I'm not very experienced or, you know, very realized to speak about others as a principle, but I can speak about myself, is that two things I observe on a daily basis is that either I'm absent in my relationship with Krishna, or I'm impersonal in my relationship with Krishna. Absent in the sense that just keep doing what you need to do, but not really pausing for a moment to understand what's the purpose of why I'm doing it. And it's natural, because, you know, we get like this automatic machine. You get up at a particular time every day, you do certain activities. Like, as devotees, we are supposed to do early morning when we get up, so we just do it. Oh, conch is going to, you know, blow at 4:30. Oh, I'm 3 minutes late, like, you know. But every time I'm late for Mangal Aarti, my whole thing is, oh, 4:30, you know, conch is going to blow, and oh, I'm late by 3 minutes or 4 minutes or something. And then much later, maybe at the end of the day, when I am actually reflecting my day, I realize that while I was conscious that I'm late, the conch is going to blow, or the conch has already blown, what my thought doesn't go to, man, I was not there to greet Krishna. I miss being there to look at, you know, to Krishna to see me early morning, and, you know, he's happy with his smile and I'm happy to see him. All those devotional feelings don't come at that time, because, and that's being absent. So, but if we actually, even in the smallest of small things, if we can put that kind of thought, devotional life is very simple. And believe me, the days we do like that, Krishna reciprocates, but becomes one of the, even though you may have hundreds of things to do, everything may be going wrong, but somehow Krishna, at the end of the day, you feel very satisfied because you feel Krishna's presence in your life. You suddenly feel, oh, today the deity. I hear this many, very often, who visit Chicago, and some devotees have told me, oh, Krishna looks very chubby and happy and he's smiling. And some people have come and told me, oh, he looks very thin and like, you know, he's grown thin. I see him every day, so I don't see the difference. But some devotees see, and then when they see he's chubby and happy, I feel good. And when they say he looks thin, I feel, oh man, maybe he's not eating, he's not happy with what we are offering. So actually he's there. And suddenly if our disposition is, our mood is, you know, hey, I want to come at 4:30 when the conch blows, because I'm eager to see Krishna, and I want Krishna to see that I'm eager to see him. And suddenly we feel that the deities are really smiling, their smile is big, you know. But it's like if the mood is, oh man, you know, if I don't go, Mother Himangi will be there and she'll be like, you know, oh, I'll get a text from her right after Bhagavatam class, where were you, what were you doing, you know. So I don't want her to be on my case, so I have to be for Mangala Arati, being absent. But if you understand why Mother Himangi or anybody else, wherever you go, wants you to be there for Mangala Arati, there is a benefit to be there in Mangala Arati, to be there for, you know, one of the biggest struggle for me is the whole Shikshashtaka prayers we do after the Mangala Arati. I'll be very honest, I have to confess, this is my confession. It's a big struggle for me to be there. Even those 10 minutes for me is one round. And I'm thinking, man, if I'm here, I'm losing my time, because I already have done few rounds, so I have done my prayers before I start my chanting. So I'm thinking, you know, I have to go home, cook, you know, get Prahlad ready for school, send Prabhu to work. I have so many things to do. These 10 minutes are really crucial. And I don't want to chant again the whole Shikshashtaka prayers and the whole meaning, you know. But, you know, I have to go through that, because if I understand the deeper meaning, okay, if I have to do 100 times, I should be happy to do it 100 times. The same thing over and over again. If we don't have taste, it's our material mind. If we have taste, it's our spiritual mind. So the simplicity comes from understanding these finer aspects of Krishna consciousness. And if we develop that simplicity, then automatically there is satisfaction. And gravity. See, you cannot control your we cannot control our senses if we don't have gravity. And I lack in that. I struggle with that. But at one level I struggle, at one level I have an understanding. Because if there is no gravity, one cannot really introspect, one cannot objectively reflect where you want to go, how you can improve, how to internalize one's instructions. So gravity for a devotee is a very important quality to develop. If there is no gravity, one cannot control one's senses. One just goes with whatever the senses dictate, because there is no contemplation, there is no reflection, like, you know, reflection can say, because the mind says something and we just go, and you know, and then we realize later, but it's okay, we are conditioned for millions and millions of years to be like that. So one lifetime may not be enough for some, and for some one lifetime may be enough to transcend the conditioning of the mind. But we should not give up. There has to be this, we have to cultivate this quality of gravity. Who we are, what is our responsibility as being a member of such an amazing lineage, spiritual lineage. We have no qualification, and yet you know, we have been accepted by this amazing disciplic succession, these amazing teachers and Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. And once we understand, like, you know, wow, I am part of such an amazing family, so let me do my part. And what is my part? My part is just be, you know, be satisfied in the day-to-day program that I've been given. I don't have to do much. Krishna, we need certain services to keep our mind and our body engaged. But what is more important to be engaged in those, I'm repeating myself because it's important, is that to do those activities and to do those services, what is more important is the cultivation of the consciousness. Like, something that I observe, and I see this in Jitendra Prabhu, is that, you know, those of Prabhupada disciples and who have been serving for 50 years, they don't wait for others to do, if something is lying around or something needs to be done, they don't wait for others to do, they just do it. If it means like simple thing like cleaning the prasadam table that's dirty. I observe because that's a trigger for me, so I observe how many devotees, if they haven't eaten and if they haven't if that's not where they sat and ate the prasadam, or if they're just passing through the prasadam hall, how many devotees feel, oh, the table looks dirty, let me take a minute and just wipe it. There's only one person in this building and we know who it is who does that. But generally, I've not seen anybody do it. If the staircase are dirty, we wait for somebody else. Like, I'm not being critical. We all are overwhelmed, actually, because we have so much going on. But the overwhelming feeling, and including myself, I struggle and I have to get my mind back to this principle, is it comes because when we are trying to function on the platform of I need to do this, I need to do that, we look at each service as a chore. But the day, you know, I think I can cultivate this mood that this is how it's going to be in the spiritual world, constant service. Constantly, you have to pluck flowers, you have to string garlands, you have to clean the garden, you have to clean this and you have to cook this, and you know, that's what is happening. And the gopis and the gopas and everybody is very happy serving, you know, Radharani and Krishna. That, and we are in Vaikuntha, we are in their house. And if we, each one of us, can somehow go deep into that feeling, then it becomes clean, it becomes neat, and somehow Krishna makes the 24 hours 48 hours. And everyone gets to, then the moment you do everything clean and neat, then obviously you will realize, like one will realize, at least this has been my realization, is that, or experience, is that you do get time to read Bhagavatam. Lot more than when you thought that I need to first do my Bhagavatam, and like, you know, we have to, every day we have to read our Bhagavatam, we have to hear, you know, and purify our consciousness. But sometimes I have devotees who come and tell, you know, my tendency or my mood is like, you know, or my interest is that I really like to read 2 or 3 hours of Srimad Bhagavatam. And I generally sometimes see these kind of devotees, they literally have to be told, can you help me with pots, or can you help me, because they think that temple presidents are always interested in giving, you know, practical devotional service, you know, they don't encourage so much. I've heard this, and I'm not being critical, it's true, a temple president does do that. I'll be very honest, as a temple president, I'm constantly thinking how this needs to be done. So that that understanding or that experience with a manager, it's true. And sometimes the managers do tend to push people to do things because things need to be done. But at the same time, if we understand that if we change the attitude and the consciousness, Krishna will make everything happen. Why he won't expand your day so you can read more about him? Why won't he give you an opportunity to preach about him, to talk about him, to sing his glories? He will give. So as a devotee, we have to be an all-rounder devotee. Every devotee has to be an all-rounder. They may have some special skill. One may be an amazing cook, a speaker, a preacher, a pujari, you know, a housewife, whatever. But it's not that that's the only aspect of Krishna consciousness one should focus. One should focus to develop everything. Because who knows, once we go back to spiritual world, what kind of service Krishna Radharani would like us to get involved with. We don't know, so we need to get qualified. And I think I'll stop here. Anything to add? Anything, any comment? Okay, Ruchi Mataji has, I hope it's not a tough question. I'm not very good at answering questions.
You just said that, you know, the effort we make, I forgot my the exact thing, but I had heard in a previous place that Krishna says, I am the strength of the, bal balvantam aham, right? So for that, I was thinking that many times we make a resolution, but even like for a relationship with Krishna, it's only if he empowers, or if only if I had this question in the Bhagavad Gita class also, where he says that you can control the senses by detachment and knowledge, but only no matter how hard you sometimes try, it is just not possible to control how you react to certain circumstances. Like you said that it is up to us to control our senses, because but it is not really control of the senses also, but like gravity, you talked about gravity, so even that might be something which Krishna influences. So do you think we should just pray to Krishna for strength of gravity, or for the strength of contemplation, contemplate things deeply? Even sometimes, like if one is just like, even a simple example, like if you are on the food table and you are feeling very hungry, and you just, and everything is really nice, and you know you should not enjoy it because it is really just bodily needs that you are fulfilling, and you should not relish it, maybe thinking that it's Krishna Prasad. It's just an example that I'm trying to give. So where is the thing, like, should we ask Krishna for controlling our mind and senses, or should we like put our maximum endeavor in it more? Like, what is better?
The best, you answered your own question, and I'll just elaborate what the answer is. It's true, we have to pray to Krishna. If you do it on your own strength, then it's not really devotional service, because it's, you're doing it with an understanding that I, so and so, I have the strength, or I don't have the strength to do, or I have the strength to do, and so I'll do this much. Devotional mood is, I don't have the strength, so my dear Krishna, I have this very deep desire that I want to be this, but somehow I'm not able to find the inspiration, or somehow I don't have the strength, even though I have the desire, or the body that supports this desire. Let my heart be open to that mercy you can give, because any task or any service that comes our way, the empowerment is already there. So one needs to pray that, let me have access to that empowerment. The inability to do something is lack of inability to actually access that empowerment that is there. So we need to pray, my dear Krishna, you know, let my heart be open to receive that empowerment. Let me access, let me give the intelligence, please give me the mood, the humility, whatever it means, whatever is, you know, preventing, you know, so that I can access your empowerment. And if I'm unable to access the empowerment, my dear Krishna, can you please open my heart and my eyes to see why I'm unable to access that empowerment? It is very personal. The moment you do that, you will see, suddenly you feel empowered. I am telling you something very honestly. If you go and tell my mom, you know, if any one of you go and tell my mom, I was sharing this with Jay Baldev the other day. Anything that I do here, my mom won't believe. Because I never like to do household chores. I was a tomboy. I like to play soccer and I would like to play cricket. I would be with the boys out playing all day. My second sister was like, you know, Sri Rupa, you know, always there. She was my mom's assistant and my mom would always curse me, you know. Look at your sister, she's so good and you're useless, you're like a boy, like blah, 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 blah. And I said, I'll marry a guy who will not expect me to do any of these things. And fortunately, Krishna did get me married to a guy who never put any of this, you know, he was not this Indian male chauvinist who expected, you know, he was very understanding. But Krishna tricked me. When I came to Krishna consciousness, the first service he gave me was a service I never liked to do. Cook. I was my spiritual master's cook almost every day. That those days used to be more often in Chicago and I used to be in the suburbs. So imagine cook, drive, and I used to cook for Chandramouli Swami too. And I know what you're saying because at that time I felt miserable. Yeah. I would literally cry. I said, well, for all this, I would go and tell Murari, of all the services, this is the service I got. And till date, I still cook. So, and through that experience, what I've understood, I've gone through my whole experience of, you know, feeling frustrated, wanting to run away, wanting to, I used to think, oh, I want to be a leader, I want to be a preacher, then I can avoid being a cook. You know, I had all my plans, you know, all kinds of plans. But finally, I realized over hearing the same thing over and over from different speakers, I was depending on my own conception of who I am, what I'm good at, and what I would like to do. Nowhere in the picture there was Krishna or mood of service, even though they were devotional activities. Then eventually I had to learn to pray to Krishna, man, you're not going to let me go, so somehow you make my heart, you know, open and, you know, and be grateful that you have given me this service. Then came this whole understanding, wow, that is Radharani's kitchen. Man, she cooks every day for him. What qualification do I have that I can cook for Kishore every day? Then I felt very grateful to Srimati Radharani that, like, you know, she gives me the permission. And believe me, you all know me. I'm pretty temperamental. So right when I'm cooking, and in those days there were a lot of devotees living in the temple, so somebody will say or do something and I'll get irritated. I'll just react. I'll forget that I'm cooking for Kishore. And guess what? You know, I'm famous at getting all these burns, cuts. Every day, Rajbhog cooking 5 days a week, either burnt or cut my finger somewhere. And that would be an instant, you know, that was Radharani's mercy. She would remind me, don't be distracted. So it's beautiful. I'm not here like I like to talk about myself, but, you know, I want to share with devotees that Krishna consciousness is very practical, and Kishore Kishori especially, I've only served them in such intimacy, like, you know, doing personal service for them. They're my only deities that I have served in that capacity, and my home deities. Believe me, they're very merciful and they reciprocate immediately if you just have that right attitude and the right mood. So it's okay. Nobody is expecting that, Ruchi, you have to do this. You know, and somebody may come and tell, I would like you to do this service. Don't immediately say no. You can say, okay, let me think about it. And the thinking process is you come and stand here. And then pray for the empowerment to, the empowerment is there. Pray for your heart to be open to receive that empowerment. And today, I'm fearless. I can cook anything, I'll do anything. And I don't have that aversion that I had before, like, you know, 20 years ago. And it's magical. It's very magical. Everything about Krishna is very magical. But you should have the guts to experience that magic. It takes guts. It takes a lot of confidence and trust in Krishna to experience that magical transformation. So in that sense, when you talk about simplicity and gravity, this is the point. The attitude and disposition of the heart. Okay? Yes, Devala. I hope it is a short and not complicated questions, because sometimes I think I can never answer your questions. Because
Hare Krishna.
Huh? Oh, you can't hear? Oh, sorry.
Thank you for your class. Well, you last mentioned that you don't like to talk about yourself, but on the contrary, I love when devotees talk about themselves because usually it's not in an egoist way, and it makes it more personal, because I was just telling Giridhar yesterday, when I first opened these chapters, I got exhausted from reading all the dynasties of so many names, and it's like a disconnect when you hear so many names you can't even pronounce. You tune out. And that's why I don't have too much comment on the Bhagavatam today, because I was making that point to him also, that when you hear people's personal lives and they could connect it to the Bhagavatam, I think that makes it more enlivening, because you know, everyone has their obstacles, and you relate to the Bhagavatam, you can relate to it. So my question is, I guess if I ask a question, sometimes devotees are reluctant to talk about themselves in any capacity. Usually you don't hear devotees speaking about you know, their personal life, like how great of a devotee I was in my past. My mother always glorified me. You say your mother always criticized you, so you're not exactly glorifying yourself. You say all the obstacles. So how is it important, is it, at least for me, I could say what nourishes my Krishna consciousness, when I get to hear personal stories, that makes feelings much better with devotees, because sometimes, you know, that's the tendency. We don't want people to see our faults. So everyone seems like walking with a facade of perfection on it. You feel very impersonal. You feel like zombies walking around. You don't get to hear anyone person. So how important is it for you, or is it for devotees in general, to explain their personal stories if they choose to? Sometimes it's too personal, but maybe you could expand on that a little bit.
See, there is a place. Can you hear? In Krishna consciousness, like in the spiritual world, there is variety. So we have to be, we have to have this understanding that even here, there will be variety. What I have been told, and I have been deeply contemplating this for many years, is that there is place for all kinds of personalities and all kinds of styles. Some speakers, they're very good at talking on principles, and they can go deeper and deeper without getting personal. And it is not that they're impersonal. It must be their personal nature. Somebody may be extremely shy, you know, and extremely uncomfortable to be in a public forum to speak something personal, because that's who they are. And so they cannot change their nature. Because maybe some other speaker, when they speak their personal realization, everybody says, yay, I like their class because it's so personal. One has to, and he or she may attract somebody like them. And people like somebody like me, who is more into personal, may attract, you know, because you're like-minded. So maybe you may feel, oh, I like her class. So there is place for everyone, and we just need to respect. We cannot, there may be so many factors why somebody is personal and somebody is not personal, you know. And we cannot, so there is, there's place for everyone. There's no right way or wrong way or better way or, you know, whatever. Whatever works for anybody. But something that this is one thing I love, that, you know, this devotee once shared this in a Bhagavatam class. He said that Srimad Bhagavatam and purpose of Srila Prabhupada are so potent that irrespective of who the speaker is, an amazing speaker or not so amazing speaker, but if one sits in the class and with the thing goes, you know, Prabhupada is personally, you know, sharing this for me, and he's talking to me, and Krishna is speaking to me, or this Acharya is speaking to me. And no matter how the speaker is speaking, at the end of the class, there'll be some take-home points for you, because your heart is totally open to the message of Bhagavatam. That's how potent Bhagavatam is, and to add to it, we have Prabhupada's purpose. So even if sometimes, you know, the words are difficult, the Sanskrit words, for me sometimes, you know, some of the words that Prabhupada uses, the English words, I have not used it, and I don't even know how to pronounce them, because we never learned phonics in India. We just learned by hearing whatever the teacher says, but we never understood the logic of how sound, each word sounds and how you use it. So sometimes you will even hear me mispronouncing things, you know, but it's okay. So don't tune out. You be very present to the message that's been written, and you keep, every time I tune out, I keep telling myself, keep your heart open, keep your heart open. Because you know what? The person who's sitting here has put in a lot of efforts and took lot, I would say, courage. For me, it was nerve-wracking to sit here yesterday and today to speak, because I don't see myself as a public speaker. So you can at least appreciate that in a mood of service, this person is, you know, sitting here. And just, you know, today I'm really fortunate. There are a few souls here. Yesterday Giridhari was there. It so happened that I didn't have anything going on, so I was in Bhagavatam class, and it so happened that Mother Irina happens to be in the temple, so she was there. If we both followed whatever we need to do, there would nobody be in the class when he starts Jai Radha Madhava. And I told him, you would be speaking to the four walls. You know, sometimes it could be like, you know, pretty austere for a person to just speak to almost an empty room. So there's so much, you know, so we can just appreciate, you know, the effort that's been put. Because to be very honest, how many people really like to be here and be the, like, you know, 20 faces looking at you and you speaking? It's all austere. For me, it's a lot of austerity. So it's okay that somebody can just speak on basis of the principles, and somebody can speak with little personal touch. Whatever works for you and others. Okay.
Hare Krishna. Your answer to that, I think that's a very profound point, and that's one of the most important points to me in Krishna consciousness, would help me in Krishna consciousness. Before I got initiated, I never liked to hear Bhagavatam, only from my favorite speaker, you know, usually one or two people. And of course, my brother was one of them. But what changed my life is I saw a short lecture about Radhanath Maharaj right before initiation. I watched it a lot of times, and he basically said the same thing you did, and it was about gratitude. And I think that's the most important point for my Krishna consciousness, how to be grateful for all circumstances. And because you made the point, nobody has to be in a Bhagavatam. We're very fortunate, and we could be anywhere else. And so why not tune in, you know? Otherwise, why not go somewhere else, you know, be respectful. And because the more you get the mercy of the Bhagavatam speaker, the doesn't matter who it is, then the more your Krishna consciousness flourishes. So I appreciate that point. One last question I had, you were mentioning that sometimes our nature to be shy. And I would say I was a shy person too. You know, circumstances sometimes make you not shy. And that's usually the most material nature. So I have a question. Sometimes the tendency is that we're shy about our faults. That's natural. You don't want to explain your business to everyone else, and that's natural. But can you explain a little bit how the modes propel us to also expose everyone else's faults? Usually that's the tendency. We don't want to expose our faults, you know, because we're shy or it's our nature. But at the same time, I've noticed in myself for the years, I have to watch that it's so easy. I want to be honest with devotees. So my ideal of honesty is telling everyone else's faults, even if it's embarrassing or for them, but I don't care. So can you explain a little bit about that?
When you see something in others, how to bring it up to them, or is it okay to bring it up to their attention?
In a sense that if we're not willing to expose our own faults due to our own nature, then we shouldn't be unwilling in that sense. So why are we so willing to expose everyone else's personal business?
Okay, there are different kinds. Like for instance, if you look at the spiritual master is in a different category. Let's take a temple situation. A particular department head, or the temple president, or like, you know, bhakta leader, whatever. In general, he or she may be shy, but part of his service is that he needs to give feedbacks. So if your service requires you to give feedback to somebody, then you need to do that. Otherwise, you're not doing your dharma as, like, you know, as a temple president or as a bhakta leader or as an ashram leader or sankirtan leader, whatever. Like, you know. So the person who is receiving should not feel, hey, you know, he doesn't speak about his own shortcomings, but he is very interested in talking. But he's doing that Whether that's his mood or not, it's irrelevant. From your our side, we can the mood we can take is that this person is just doing their service. You know, and then we just accept it. Because Krishna is not seeing, he's looking at both the person who's giving the feedback and the person who's receiving the feedback. Krishna is not seeing that who is right and who is wrong in this situation. What Krishna is seeing is, how is it that you are receiving the feedback he's giving, whether the feedback is right, wrong, or who is giving the feedback. But what is the mood and what is the consciousness with which you're receiving the feedback? And depending upon that, you get reciprocation from Krishna. And the person who is saying, you know, or who is giving the feedback or instructing or whatever, Krishna is also seeing how he's doing. Where is he coming from? Is it an ego thing? Oh, I'm a temple president, so now I need to, whatever. I have the adhikar or the authority to say something to somebody. If that's the thing, then he will have repercussions for that consciousness and for that mood. But if the person's mood is, you know, man, I don't like to do this. Believe me, I give a lot of feedbacks. And if you personally ask me, I hate to give feedbacks. And that's one of the reasons this is one part of the service I don't like. But I cannot, if I don't give feedback, then I'm not doing my service. So it all depends upon the conscience. So what Krishna is looking at each of them individually, he's not looking so much about the interaction that's happening. What is the consciousness of the speaker or the person who's giving feedback, and what is the purpose and in what mood they're doing it, and the person, how he's receiving it. And in all these things, we have to understand that it may be improper, it may be wrong, it can be anything. I go back, I always take strength in the Avanti Brahmana example. How eventually he felt that I deserve this. Who knows in what lifetime, what did I? So it is my karma that I'm getting this. We don't immediately come to that platform, but most of us, after some reflection, we do come to that platform, you know. So I honestly believe that every right word and the wrong word, or right action or wrong action we do, there's Krishna's hand in it. Krishna's, I would say, sanction is there in it. So if we think like that, then we can never hold too much grudge or anger or, you know, whatever, negativity towards anybody. Does that answer your question? Okay. Done? Srila Prabhupada ki? Yeah.